few seconds after 4 o'clock. Thank you for...
Tickets are now on sale for Side by Side, Union Gallery's annual major fundraiser. Join us on Saturday, February 8th for an afternoon of live music, artsy activities, and a lottery-style draw where everyone is a winner. Take home a one-of-a-kind artwork and support Union Gallery's nonprofit mission. Come visit the exhibition or check out the online catalog to see the 100-plus works available. Head to uniongallery.ca and get your tickets for Side by Side today.
Hi, this is Half Moon Run, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Hello and good morning, everyone. It is now 11 a.m. on Thursday morning. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca, broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall on the campus of Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Rue, and you're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where the Live Sessions crew brings you musical performances recorded right here in CFRC Studio A by artists from in and around Kingston, and now far beyond as well, as we begin to host bands from not only all over Canada, but even all across the world. Today we've got a session with Queen's student band Girl Dad, who makes some wonderfully melodic indie rock music. Since starting in 2022, they've played rock and indie stable venues like the Alehouse at Kingston's inaugural Ellapalooza Festival, which they will be playing again this March. They've played a momentous show at Stages this November, and just last week played a sold-out weekend show at Toronto's Horseshoe Tavern with Kings of Queens, another Queen's student band who have also been on this show. Girl Dad dropped by our studio a few weeks ago to talk about their music, past and future shows, and their upcoming debut album. Keep up with everything that they're doing on their Instagram. It's GGIRLDAD. You will soon also be able to find a video for this session up on our YouTube channel. I'm really looking forward to that. And right now, if you go on our YouTube channel, which is at CFRC Live Sessions on YouTube, you can find wonderfully short performances featuring past Live Sessions guests too. If you like those videos and you would like to be part of the Live Sessions crew in any capacity, remember, CFRC is your campus and community station, so join us, especially if you're someone who's interested in videography, filming, video editing, production. Please reach out to us. Our Instagram is CFRC Live Sessions, or our email address is livesessions@cfrc.ca. If you're an artist who would like to do a session with us here at CFRC, again, reach out. You know, we've been getting requests from bands all over. We're happy to try and find a slot for you as well. If you're someone who likes the Live Session show and you would like to help us keep doing what we do, you can donate to our station, cfrc.ca/donate. We're 101 years old. Help us keep going into year number 102. If you're interested in sponsoring this show, CFRC Live Sessions, putting your name on it and saying that you were an early supporter of one of the coolest shows on an already very cool station, again, reach out to us and we'll talk. And now, without any further ado, here's this week's session. So stay tuned for that. This is Girl Dad here on CFRC Live Sessions. Okay, we are here live at the CFRC studios, CFRC 101.9 FM. We're doing a live session here with Girl Dad. I'm Rue, and all four members of the band are here with me. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, I'm Tommy.
I'm Thomas.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Brendan.
Okay, awesome. So all four of you guys are here, Girl Dad. For people who've never heard you guys before, what do you sound like? What's the vibe?
Really good. I don't know. I guess it's like indie rock, or like I like to actually describe it as nice guy rock.
Sure.
Yeah.
I can see
just
that.
Just because of what we're singing, I think.
We can't be bad boys though. Doesn't mean we can't be bad boys though.
Yeah. Mixed with bedroom pop, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess.
I've heard a lot of people say that it reminds them of like some early 2000s stuff as well, with that type of vibe.
I think there's maybe a bit of a surfer vibe too, a little bit. Yeah, surfer rock.
Like surfing.
Yeah. I hear all of that, definitely. And I mean, lyrically as well, like you said, it's sweet with a bit of sour on it. And you guys keep it very real in the lyrics. So tell me a bit about that lyrical vibe. Let's talk about it. Okay, the mic has immediately been passed on.
Yeah, I don't know. That was very impulsive.
You tell me for this.
That's a good question. I guess I don't think we have really put like any thought into like planning us a kind of theme for lyrical stuff, or like there's no kind of like concept behind any of the stuff that we write. It's just kind of like, stuff that Thomas and I have worked on and comes out and whatever. There's no really guideline in terms of like what we're writing about. It's pretty just kind of like what's going on in our lives and what's going on in our lives and things that we've been through and done, and also just fun stuff. I think we're trying to like get more fun stuff, you know, because fun.
Very autobiographical.
Segue. Yep.
Oh, yeah, sorry. No, just because our new single is called For Fun.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so we'll talk all about that, because everything that we know about like your music so far is because you had the EP out that came in the summer, Wide-Eyed Kids. And like, yeah, like you said, it's very kind of wide-eyed kids. Like the vibe is very, very much of like being out there experiencing stuff and just like writing about it. That's how it felt to me. But you are working on new music, so let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Or Brandon, do you have something to say?
Yeah, we've been over the last semester and this one, we started playing a lot of shows with the new songs on the EP, but also just a whole bunch of other ones that Thomas and Tommy have been writing, and we've been putting together a lot of cool stuff. We have some recordings done. We might be getting a new song out soon enough called For Fun, but there's also should be a lot more on the way, and hopefully we're working up to an album later on in the year, maybe.
And I think the first song that you're playing for us is off of the unreleased album at the moment.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, tell us a bit about it.
The first song we played was called Don't Go. It's the fastest song I think we play. Mm-hmm. It's we don't play it particularly like with a metronome live, just because, you know, the energy and whatnot. But yeah, it's our fastest one for sure, and it's a fun one.
Yeah, there's a touch of punk to it, for sure.
A touch of punk. At our last show, I accidentally said funk. Like, I was like, this next one's like a funky one, or funky one. That, well, yeah, because Hannah thought it was, Hannah thought that's what I said, but I said, this is a punky one. I don't know if punky is really a word, but.
And then she walks up to us and she's like, I like the funky one. We're like, what are you talking about?
We don't play funk, dude.
That's for album number two.
Genderless bathroom, let me see the new tattoo and kiss me now. Easy were the days before summer. We were passionate lovers and we talked for hours. Play another tune, drive you in my car. Girls, another love. Sun to freeze the grass, I will never pass. Honey, I can't focus in class. Don't go, don't go.
You've just heard Don't Go.
We're Girl Dad.
There we go.
Nice.
So we are here with Girl Dad live at TFRC. You guys have, that's clearly like you guys working on your acting skills for the single release, for the music videos.
Absolutely.
Are there plans for that?
Music videos? Actually, yeah. We have a couple inquiries about doing a music video. Nothing's nothing's planned yet, but the main focus right now is recording for sure. Mm-hmm. And like the two shows we have coming up, but no, music videos are really fun, so hopefully we'll get one, or at least one.
A friend of Thomas's from Toronto actually came up to one of our shows at the Broom Factory early in the year and put together a music video for I guess it's kind of like I called it a visualizer for Crossbreeze, and it was just kind of like some concert footage and then kind of like putting the audio behind it, and then put together a full music video for Minus 33, which is super cool. I think we've had some people reach out. I think it's like, it's nice being at Queens because you'll always have people that are in classes and they're like, oh, I have to do a music video. Like, do you guys? And it's like, yeah, sure. Awesome. So we like, that'll probably end up coming hopefully like later in the year. But yeah, again, like focusing on recording, mixing, all the kind of stuff, because I don't know, there's kind of like a tighter timeline for that in terms of just like, we want to have stuff out. We've been playing it live for 4 months and like no one can listen to it anywhere. So it's like, we want to like make sure that like our music's available, Spotify, Apple Music, all that kind of stuff. As soon as possible.
Yeah, I remember one of those visualizers. It was very like 80s and VHS like.
And that was the idea, yeah.
And even though obviously you said that, you know, you feel like it's a very zero sound, it did fit this 80s vibe, like a very kind of jangly, jangle pop 80s, like, can I say Smiths-ish?
Sure.
Indie vibe?
Open to interpretation. No, yeah. Callum's my good friend from home. He's awesome. Shout out Callum. Shout out 1420. I think his big thing is using a VHS to make music videos. He does it a lot for like other rappers in Toronto. And it just like fits the DIY vibe that we have, I guess. So no, it's perfect.
And now you were talking about all these songs that you've been playing at shows. And, a little before we recorded this interview, you guys just opened for Kiwi Jr. at the Grad Club. And that was, I mean, I've been telling you guys, I feel we're the perfect band to open for them. So tell me a bit about that show. Like, what was it like just getting in there? Because they've been on tour recently. They've opened for, like, Pavement, Dinosaur Jr., all those guys.
Yeah, I think, like, Brennan and I went to a Rap Boys concert in Montreal, like, I want to say September or October. And it was super fun. But on the way back, I remember we were listening to Kiwi Jr. And we were both saying, like, they're so cool. Like, they're definitely one of the best indie bands in Canada. Like, love their stuff, all that kind of stuff. And then, like, 2 weeks later, we got a DM, and I remember being like, is this, like, spam or something?
Yeah, I kind of thought it was fake. I was like, there's no way that, like, Kiwi Jr. would suddenly want to play a show with us, but then it seems like, well, it did happen.
Yeah.
And it was super fun.
Yeah, super nice guys, and definitely, I think there was, like, or at least for me, it was, like, a little bit intimidating, like playing with them at the very start, just because like it's like these guys are real pros, like their stuff's really tight, really cool, like real professionals. But it was also, so it was like humbling for sure, but also just cool to like, I think that we've had exposure to like a Queens crowd, and there's like the Queens music fans, but also like we want to kind of like have other people in Kingston or in the area that like are like that style of music, like indie rock, that will come out to see us, not just because they go to Queens and they're friends with somebody, you know what I mean? So I think it's cool to like expand kind of fan base per se, and kind of like attract some more people that maybe don't go to Queens or that aren't or that don't know us personally, I guess.
Yeah, I think you guys went down pretty well. So how do you like prepare for a different crowd? Because, you know, when Queens bands come out, you know, the Queens like students who come out to see you guys will come. And now, like you said, you're playing to new faces almost. How do you prepare for that? How do you like, do you have to up the crowd chatter and things like that?
Yeah, I think that we probably just like did it like via our set list. And I think that we wouldn't say that like we catered to the non-Queens crowd. I think that unfortunately the reality is like when you're playing to a crowd of students at like a party show, you could call it, like a show where it's like supposed to be really fun, like you kind of want to mix in some more covers and like make it a fun experience, play some stuff that they know. Whereas like with our Kiwi Jr. show, and I think a lot more like as we kind of play more and more shows, a lot more we're just being like, okay, let's just put one or two covers and just kind of focus on our stuff, because we've been working hard on it and we're proud of it. So it's like at some point you can't please everybody. You just got to kind of like have the people that enjoy your stuff and not worry about the rest.
The Kiwi Jr. show was also the first show we played no covers, which was really exciting, and it felt really good.
And it went down really well. But then, you know, the other side, like you said, is the student shows. And there is one that happened recently that I do want to talk to you guys about. It was the show that you guys did with Kings of Queens at Stages. Now, I don't think there's been a student band at Stages in a while. I think the last band as a whole to play Stages was probably the Glorious Sons when they did their like snowed in Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve concert. So we haven't had student bands at Stages in a while. So, like, what was that like going into it? I know I spoke to you guys at the show, but then, you know, the show happened. It was great. Everyone was having a great time. So just from your side, tell me about that show.
That was my favorite show that we've played so far. That was a lot of fun. I'm the new drummer, so this year this has been my biggest gig with these guys, and it was a lot of fun. Kings of Queens did great, and so did DJ Aqua, and the crowd turnout was amazing, and it was just the sound was great, the lights were great. It was just all around a great experience.
Mm-hmm. And like it's a much bigger venue as well than say the Grad Club or, you know, Clark Hall and things like that. So that's a big venue to fill, like sound and stage show wise as well.
Yeah. I think we were like really hyped up, but it didn't really compare to when we actually like pulled up there for sound check. And because when you normally go to stages on like a weekend for the club vibe, not that I would go there. No, I don't go there. No, but like you never see the DJ booth down. And so like, They actually turned the back bar into the stage where the drums were. So we realized, like, oh my gosh, Paul is going to be above us. And we were like, we have, like, so much space in the stage. And then there's, like, this, like, step-up thing right at the front of the stage where Tommy and Brendan did some sick solos up there. I don't know. We're really lucky to have had that opportunity.
Yeah, and the crowd got involved. I saw some of the pictures that people in the front just like reaching out and screaming and stuff like that. It was a really good show.
Yeah, we got positive feedback from it, so we're really stoked about it. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just going to say too that I feel like it's nice for us. There's kind of like a dichotomy of like we play at stages where you have all this room and like you have a lot of people there to see you, and then like switching over to the Grad Club where it's like the smallest stage ever, and it was like kind of a more intimate feel and like people that like I guess passionate music fans that were there to see Kiwi Junior, like there for to support like local music, which is super cool. So it's kind of cool to like get a bit of both and like have opportunities to play bigger shows, but also like play some smaller venues, have it be a little bit more intimate, and just kind of stand and deliver, I guess. At Grad Club, we couldn't really move around a whole lot, but it was cool. Like, it was also like again a historic venue that has seen a lot of cool bands. So I think that like we're running out of venues, I think, in Kingston that we haven't played, but as we play more and more, it's just fun to like kind of feel some of the history, and like every different venue has different character, which is fun.
And I mean, for a band that's been around for a single year, it's great that you guys already are coming to a point where you need to strip it back and play like the intimate venues and things like that. So that's incredible. But another crowd pleaser that you guys have is the next song that you're going to be playing, isn't it?
The next one was off our original EP. It's called -33. You can see it on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your music. It's on YouTube with that new music video that we mentioned. Check it out.
It's called -33. It's off our first EP.
Haven't slept well in a week. My clothes are dirty. Never washed my sheets. February's looking bleak. The sun is hiding. It's -33. All my friends are making money. I can't keep track how much I lost this week. I am so counterproductive. My feet, climb down, suck it up. Calm down, try your luck. She was one and she liked me. Oh, I was tired, I could barely speak. Maybe next time we could meet. Share songs and rewatch happy things. I'm the opposite of Midas.
down, try your luck. Put down, suck it up. Calm down, try your luck. February's looking bleak. My clothes are dirty. It's minus 33.
Thanks so much, guys. Hey, we're Girl Dad, and that was minus 33.
We're back here. Girl Dad is still with us. You guys just played minus 33 CFRC live sessions. And what have you guys got coming up next? Because, like, it's a busy 4 months. First of all, you are engineers. Well, most of you are engineers. It's a busy time. But musically as well, you've got stuff planned.
Yeah, yeah. We mostly want to record because we have a lot to do still. But, no, we've got a show on February 10th at Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto, which we're really excited for. That's going to be with Kings of Queens again and this band called Taplin. And then we're doing another show in March. Yeah. Mid-March.
Nothing else confirmed, but probably a few others here and there, you know, as we get closer to the dates.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, these shows are pretty dynamic because I just remembered, you guys are a band with basically two lead singers, right? Like, that's how you kind of split all the duties.
Yeah. Tommy will write his own songs, I'll write my own songs. Sometimes we'll meld them together. We'll all try to contribute to the new ones, and yeah.
No egos in the band just yet. We don't have, like, the Lennon McCartney situation yet.
Yeah.
This one's a Tommy song. No. This one's a Thomas song.
No, I think that last May, I guess, last April, May, when we kind of wrote the EP and started to piece things together, was super fun and kind of just like taking bits and pieces from stuff that we had written individually and then also together. And I think it was also super cool, like, coming back in the fall, like, introducing Paul to the band and having Brendan back after the summer and kind of like getting the chance to kind of figure out how it was all going to come together as a band and kind of write new parts for new songs, which is super fun. Like, writing as a group was fun when we kind of like got into some new stuff. I think that we've kind of struck a nice balance so far. I think, like, a lot of Thomas's songs have been, like, a lot of the stuff that Thomas writes has been a little bit more on the punk side, and then a lot of the stuff that I write, I guess, personally, is, like, a little bit more folky. And I think we've kind of, like, met in the middle somewhere where it's kind of, like, you get this kind of indie rock, punk, whatever sound, which is fun. So I think it's, like, cool that, like, we've had this balance so far, like, which has been good in terms of, like, what, like, each of us, all four of us, like, bring to the table and kind of, like, putting in, like, I don't know, different flavors of what we want in our sound, which has been fun.
Yeah, I think you can hear it in the sound, definitely. So we're going to be seeing you guys around town in March, and Toronto will see you guys in a little while. Not sure if this is going to go out before that, but Kingston will see you guys in and around March. The album hopefully should be there before the end of the semester, you were saying.
That's the hope. Everything goes to plan.
Any dream shows or dream, like, headline supports, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, I haven't played Ale House yet, and we're going to be doing that soon, so I think I'm very excited for that personally.
Alpalooza 2.
Which, yeah, that's
El
right.
Alpatooza. I mean, dream, are we talking about dream opening?
Yeah.
Dude, I want to open for Geese.
Yeah.
Go Wild.
Geese. Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Beyonce.
Yeah. Ed Sheeran could probably open for us. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
The Ed Sheeran beef continues.
Yeah. We like to support smaller artists. They didn't hear that.
Yeah, Super Bowl's okay. Approached us, but, like, you know, we're not sure if we want to do it. So.
Clearly.
No, you need to find the time between the grad club gigs to, like, fit in the Super Bowl.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're gonna have to really show you something that's better than the grad club to lure you in.
We also have some merch coming. Finally, we've gone like a year and a half without having any merch. So we're kind of waiting on an order to come in for some shirts and stuff like that, which we'll have at the Toronto show, and then likely, depending on how we'll do it, we'll have maybe some leftover, maybe a new order for any kind of Kingston shows coming up, so people can rep some Girl Dad wherever they may go.
Oh, Girl Dad on the runway pretty soon. Yeah. Well, we'll go to one last song. This has been so much fun. So thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you.
Okay, what's the last song we're going to go out with?
This has been so much fun, and our last song is called For Fun. Yeah, and it's a new single coming out soon, hopefully.
Soon.
Very soon.
#soon.
Hopefully before February 10th.
Okay, well, here we are on CFRC.
I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh. Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
Today and next week on Wings, you'll hear two Syrian women exiles who've remained deeply involved with their home country. In 2012, they talked with producer Kate Raphael about the extensive work of women organizers for peace and democracy who risked their freedom and their lives to stand up to the Assad regime. When Assad fled to Russia December 8, 2024, Kate interviewed them again for Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. In lieu of our usual Wings sound logo, here's the sound of Syrian women celebrating in the streets.
The world was stunned on December 8, 2024, when Syrian President Bashar al-Assad left Syria, ending his family's half-century of totalitarian control. It was not only those outside Syria who failed to anticipate the collapse of the regime. Even those most directly involved in its defeat never believed that they were about to succeed. As they threw open the prison doors, releasing people who had been held for decades, Syrians struggled to comprehend what was happening. Here are some sounds from the liberation of women in the infamous Saidnaya prison, where tens of thousands were imprisoned during the last 13 years, and an estimated 30,000 prisoners were executed. How did this happen? To understand, I spoke to two Syrian women I interviewed 12 years ago at the beginning of the Syrian uprising, which was also a time of hope for Syrians living in exile. Dr. Afra Jalabi is an affiliate assistant professor at the Department of Cultures and Religions at Concordia University in Montreal. Her interests revolve around dialogue, comparative religion, and nonviolence. She was a weekly columnist in the Arab press for about 20 years. Mohija Kaf is a Syrian-born poet and novelist and professor of comparative literature and Middle East studies at the University of Arkansas on lands of the Osage and Quapaw nations. She's a winner of the Pushcart Prize for her writing and was honored in 2018 by the Democratic Black Caucus of Northwest Arkansas for lifetime achievement in inclusion in education. Today, I'll bring you the first part of my conversation with these two Syrian activists and commentators, and we will continue the discussion next week. The first part focuses on what has happened in the last 13 years. In the next episode, we'll focus on the prospects for the new government and what they hope to see as a transition to democracy. Can you just start by telling us a little about yourselves and how you'd like people to understand your position with regard to the Syrian revolution. Mohija, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Mohija Qahif. I was born in Damascus and immigrated to this country with my parents when they were students in the early 70s and earned my own exile by the late 90s for writing about Syria, specifically in the context of Syrian literature and how it's never allowed to address the huge events of Syria, to the huge wounds of Syria. And in 2011, I began to try to amplify the voices of the nonviolent protesters in the Syrian uprising, you know, working with them on Facebook and Skype and writing, talking and so on with them and about them And I've since published some studies of women's nonviolence campaigns in the Syrian uprising. And I am also a poet, and I have a whole manuscript of poetry about Syria since 2011. It attempts to annotate almost through poetry the history of women's participation and uprising. I haven't been able to get it published because publishers are like, what is this? What is Syria? We see a few mother-daughter poems in here. Would you, you know, want to make a mother-daughter manuscript out of it? It just doesn't register. Syria doesn't register.
Afra, do you want to tell us a little about yourself?
So I was born in Damascus. Then my family left when I was 5 to Germany. We were losing the Arabic language, so my parents would send us back and forth, and at some point they moved to Saudi Arabia, and I did my high school there. My uncle is a well-known scholar among Syrians. He passed away 2 years ago. He was really interested in nonviolent reform of self and other, and so I grew up in a very nonviolent atmosphere in terms of theory and practice. My family is also from the Golan Heights, where we actually, the family homes are being returned after they've been either bombed or taken by the regime. Our own family home is standing, but totally tattered. So I thought that, like my dad said, it's a metaphor for the Syrian people. They're emerging from a 54-year-old brutal dictatorship. And so my connections to the Arab world, also being from the Golan, my grandmother's village is an Israeli settlement, and my own family have been in prison and out for many years. In fact, just a few days ago, we have a cousin who was taken by the regime authorities 43 years ago, when his son, one year old. He's slowly becoming a symbolic figure for the prisoners. His name is Raghid Tatari. He is the cousin of my mother. And I remember I was in third grade when he disappeared. And for 10 years, we didn't know anything about him. And then my aunt and other family members found out which prison he was. And then many years later, they were able to finally see him. And there were some few occasions where they could visit, until one of our younger cousins was arrested for 3 years over a couple of emails, and he ended up meeting him in Sidnaya. And now we're discovering, at some point, yes, maybe it was a prison compound, but in the last 13 years, it seems it had become a death camp. The stories are beyond shocking. So a lot of Syrians, our personal, when we talk about ourselves, we cannot talk about Syria without talking about detentions, disappearances, torture. We lost a lot of friends, some of them common friends between me and Mohja, to torture in the last 13 years. So it's a historic time for Syrians. The other day I wrote a post that if you see people who are elated on cloud 9, even a few inches walking on air, a few inches above the ground, but their eyes are puffy from so much crying, you should know you're in the presence of Syrians.
I love that. And I'm speaking to you all from the West Bank in Palestine. And I think that what you're saying is equally true for Palestinians. Even when they're celebrating, there's so much pain.
And I'm very eager to talk about Palestine, because that also is a struggle that is paramount in my heart. And really, I don't even know any Syrians for whom Palestine is not dear to their heart and the struggle paramount to their heart.
Let's turn to the events of last week. Most of us in the U.S. and Europe were completely shocked by the fall of the Assad regime. As you said, Mohja, no one was paying attention to Syria for the last, at least 11 years. How surprised were you, and how do you interpret what has happened?
So in May, last May, I was talking to some activists who live in Gaziantep, and they had to, you know, become refugees. And they were right there in the mix, protesting and then doing humanitarian work in the early years. So these folks are Syrian commies. But anyway, I was gathering news from them and others about the state of mind and the state of people inside Syria. And it was despair. It was such despair that I heard several cases that just absolutely chilled and broke my heart, that entire families were committing suicide. I mean, there was just no hope. No hope at all. No hope on the horizon. Just 6 or 7 months ago.
My husband and I were reflecting on this with my dad and sisters yesterday. And I reminded my husband how, like, the last few years I was saying rationally, when after the Syrian revolution had been so brutally crushed, I was seeing no way out. I said, however, my faith in God and in this universe and in the way this universe is ordered upon justice, love, and compassion makes me feel that maybe one day we'll wake up and he will be gone. And then I remembered how Mohja, at the beginning of the revolution, had in one of her pieces write that there might be some Deus ex machina thing happen because of the amount of suffering that people lived through. But honestly, Kate, many Syrians around me, including myself, are saying we cannot deny the direct contribution of the innocent blood of Palestinians, especially women and children, in shifting the karma of the region and removing the brutal and violent militias, murderous militias of Hezbollah from the necks of Syrians, and pushing out Iran from the scene, which really created a vacuum around a murderous regime that relied on external powers, including Russia. The three major powers were Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. Of course, there were other Iran-backed militias. And the amount of Syrian blood, the amount of Palestinian blood, is directly connected to the shift of certain karmic energies in this region for two evil entities to fall down, almost like the third retreating. When Nasrallah was killed, a lot of Syrians tried self-restraint. But the people in Idlib, like that liberated area, yes, they were distributing sweets, because when Israel would bomb certain areas in Syria, the Assad regime, Iran, and Hezbollah would consider the Syrian revolutionaries agents of Zionism. And instead of retaliating at those who hit them, they would go and bomb Idlib, the northwest of Syria. And they were bombing their own people. And so the events, in a way, were sudden and surprising. And I have a friend who's now like planning to go inside. He's been working with the coordinating councils, like in Syria. And he was telling me, he says, I can explain a lot of factors to you on the ground, but there was something also very divine about this, the shift of events, the way everything happened so fast. The Syrians found a historic moment, that this was a moment where Russia was really at a dire point in its war with Ukraine. Iran had retreated, Hezbollah completely hammered down, and Hezbollah had played a pivotal role in aiding the Assad regime. So I really, like a lot of my friends, family, we keep reminding ourselves almost daily that the blood of Palestinians has not been lost, and their celebrations and them distributing the sweets now in their turn and dancing in the streets and singing in under tents about the fall of the Assad regime shows, as Mohja said, the interconnected nature of our struggles in the region for democracy and also for freedom from occupation. Syrians were under an occupying dictatorship aided by foreign powers, and the Palestinians are also under an occupation being aided by superpowers and nuclear powers.
On Wings, you're listening to contributing producer Kate Raphael, interviewing two Syrian women exiles who've remained deeply involved with their home country. They have strong opinions and a lot of information. Before the break, you heard Afra Jalabi. Now, here is Moja Kaf.
Okay, I have a lot to say. I don't know what to start with first. I think I would like to start with Palestinians and with talking to Palestinians. I want to say two basic things, love and abundance. To Palestinians as a Syrian, I want to say, I love you and you know it. We will continue loving you and your cause because it is righteous. Released from their suffering under Assad, Syrians will figure out a way to support Palestine way more meaningful than some axis or some corridor. And what my friend Lana Barkawi, who is head of Misna Arab American Literary Journal, said immediately the first day to me was, the people are in solidarity with the people. And here, I mean, you know that I'm trying to address that tired and really horrible and dangerous delusion that Assad was about resistance to the Zionist entity in anything but rhetoric. If we ever did truly reach representative true democracy in Syria, that would represent a threat to the Zionist entity and to the U.S. So that, I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons for my pessimism and for, like, would they ever really let Syria reach a true state of democracy? And that's another thing, is that if we also really did reach, a secular, sovereign, transparent, indivisible state that guarantees individual freedoms and that has an independent judiciary and rule of law, there would be in such a Syria a tolerance for Kurdish expression of the desire for autonomy and of the desire for maybe a future independent Kurdistan, for that to be discussed. And so Turkey will not really allow us to reach a democracy that could entertain that kind of tolerance. And so those are the reasons why I'm kind of a Dahlia Downer to Afra's optimism and hope. And I really think it's a bit much asking Syrians to hope, honestly, like after so much disappointment. I'll pause there because I then want to launch into, you know, the mix of feelings that this precipitated in me and in a lot of Syrians that I talked to that had this similar mix when this operation was happening. You know, it did sweep us by surprise. First of all, the drive into Aleppo, we thought would, okay, this, you know, Alayustor is what my Aleppan friends were saying. You know, this is going to precipitate a whole regime attack on Aleppo. Civilians are going to get bombed again. And indeed, the regime did attack and cruelly shell civilians in Idlib in retaliation immediately. But as it swept further and further, you know what? Honestly, there was also a deep anger that I felt, and a very gendered anger. And I just felt like all of this was started by women. Women organized. Women have did so much to lead the 481 local coordinating councils. Major, huge swaths of them were led and organized by women, by activists, by nonviolent people whose vision was of a civil, secular state that respected all individual rights and liberties of all genders, I might say. Also, do you know that Syrian queer people were part of those protests, were in some cases key parts of those nonviolent protests? And then for this to all just be swept away, and now everyone, you know, in Syria heroizing this last gasp of the sort of distorted side of the revolution as the heroes, as the liberators. No. And for there to be this huge wave of amnesia about how all of this was really made possible by, as Afrat said, by the those who've gone before, and the fear that they may not be remembered in this. All of this is sort of churning and cycling in me as I also go to like this sense of surreal elation that Assad is gone from Syria. Do you know, this is a minor little tiny point, but I made a vow in 2012 never to cut my hair until Assad was gone from Syria. And honestly, somewhere along the line, you know, by the late teens, I guess, I just figured that I was just going to go to the end of my life, never going to a salon again or cut, you know, getting a haircut. I there was a phase where my hair started to drop and shorten from excessive swimming and the chlorine and stuff. And it was like, what is the universe trying to tell me here? You know, and I did experience that moment of elation when I did cut my hair in front of Palestinian friends and Palestinian witnesses last Sunday. But then I cycled back around to this, you know, these people that are greeting them as heroes. Do they also know that people were dying during those very same days up in northeast Syria as the Turkish-backed SNA was battling the, you know, U.S.-backed Kurdish forces there? Three women were killed in Membij, even the day after the ceasefire was made in Membij. Qamar, Aisha, Iman. You know, and there's also mourning happening. 214 or so people fell in those fights where Syrians are killing Syrians. And then I cycle back at the same time. We cannot help but also have that feeling of euphoria for a minute, you know, even though we know where we know by now, right? We've seen the Egyptians. We've seen so many other examples. We know it can only be a fleeting moment, but it is there in the mix.
Afra, I read something you said in another interview, that the Syrian civil war, quote, became a proxy war inside Syria, where 47 countries bombed Syria at different points in different situations and contexts. And I was like, 47 countries? I mean, I knew the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, but 47
Israel.
Countries. And of course, Israel, which is continuing to bomb.
Well, including Canada, because, you know, at some point there was an international coalition to defeat ISIS, which suddenly appeared in the middle of the Syrians struggling for their own liberation. And in fact, many people don't know that the regime didn't fight ISIS, so which looked really suspicious to Syrians. And a lot of the defeat of ISIS was, in many instances of confrontation, was done by the Free Syrian Army. The Syrians were at some point were fighting Hezbollah regime forces, Iran, and ISIS at the same time, and sometimes fighting amongst each other because they were splintering. And even if you look at Jolani's history, it captures this evolution of armed resistance in the region being anti-imperialist and then slowly becoming kind of organic and localized. And Jolani himself saying, I no longer belong to a global jihadi movement. I am Syrian. I come back to create my own revolution here, and which upset Al-Qaeda leaders. And there were assassination attempts on him. And then he had to get rid of Al-Qaeda supporters, and he is fairly a shrewd man, and he's a survivor.
Sorry, I just want to interrupt to clarify for our listeners that when you talk about the liberators, you're talking about the organization called Hayat Tahrir al-Shams, or known in the West as HTS. You mentioned Jolani, that's Ahmed Hussein al-Shara, whose nom de guerre was Abu Muhammad al-Jolani.
Slightly out of date to be using Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and HTS, as I understand it. So-called, supposedly, they now are just saying that's not a thing anymore. It's just the Salvation Government, Hukumat al-Inqab.
And they said that after they liberate Syria, they will dissolve themselves and they will try to reorganize themselves into a national Syrian army.
What they say?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. But for me, what I see is that what's happening, because I saw a lot of a lot of lefties saying that this is a CIA-operated takeover of Syria. Turkey is going
on. Yes, you and I agree that that is not the case and that that is preposterous.
Yes. And I still want to also roll back a little bit.
Afra now looks back at some of the violent elements of the Syrian revolution. She will mention Hezbollah, which is a faction within Lebanon that also recruited and engaged in Syria.
What happened in the last 13 years, yes, it started as a very nonviolent, peaceful revolution, almost spearheaded by women and university students. So when the peaceful the revolution was happening, the Syrians were met with brutal repression, snipers, tanks, and some bombing started. And so they couldn't protest. So a lot of Syrian soldiers started defecting from the army, even from security forces. And they were saying things that are like an oxymoron to somebody like me who's invested in nonviolent theory and practice. They were saying we will protect the nonviolence of the revolution by violent means, because they weren't aware of the dynamics of introducing elements of armed resistance into a peaceful revolution. But there were also a lot of losses. 5,000 civilians were sniped or killed. So they started forming militias and asking civilian young men to join them. So they started forming what is called like the Free Syrian Army, and there were various groups and various orientations. So then Hezbollah, actually, the Syrians know Hezbollah is not strong because kids in t-shirts and running shoes defeated Hezbollah. And then in 2014, the Iranian regime actually fully invaded Syria to support Assad because Hezbollah couldn't finish the job. And in 2014 and 2015, almost 70% of Syria was in the hands of rebels, and Iran was not able to finish the job. So Iran went to Russia and asked for the aid of Russia to come and start aerial bombardment of entire cities, the way they actually ended up doing it in Ukraine, which is why the Ukrainians, for example, have a special kind of connection to the Syrian cause, because they feel the defeat of Syrian civilians, especially the grassroots areas that supported the rebels. Putin was basically, as a consequence, emboldened to invade Ukraine after what he accomplished for Assad in Syria.
I'm Kate Raphael with Syrian-born feminist activists and scholars Afra Jalabi and Mohoja Kahaf. Dr. Afra Jalabi is affiliate assistant professor at Concordia University in Montreal and one of the founders of the Day After Project, which convened early in the Syrian revolution to envision a democratic future for Syria. Mohoja Kahaf is a poet and novelist and professor at the University of Arkansas. The discussion took place over Zoom on December 15th, 1 week after the Syrian government fell.
That concludes part one of Kate Raphael's interview. Next week in part two, the guests discuss their analyses, hopes, worries, and intentions for the future of their diverse and complex mother country, Syria.